Last night we talked a good deal about the election that is underway, that is, the campaigns that are underway. Tonight we look at campaigns of the past, and our guide is a great media historian. I think that's a fair way to designate J. Fred McDonald, who is the president of McDonald and Associates, a great archive of film and radio, which you supply materials to all sorts of people who are putting together documentaries and... probably you supply stuff to scholars as well, don't you?
Scholars, to network news, to documentary makers, sometimes advertising agencies, motion picture companies, anybody looking for old, authentic, historical footage.
What's your best way of quantifying how much old, authentic, historical footage you've got at your warehouse?
It is really difficult to do that because a film could be a 30-second TV commercial or it could be a 90-minute documentary. There's two films, but they're certainly not equal in terms of length. Like I feel like Carl Sagan, billions and billions of feet of
with
film.
With a strong plosive B.
Exactly.
We are drawing from that vast collection tonight, looking at political campaigning, presidential campaigning in the United States. But before we start, vaguely, quasi-chronologically, there's one ad that we must play as a way of illustrating, in a way, the extremity and the high drama of presidential commercial making. This goes back to, well, we'll let people remember what this goes back to. Here it is.
One, two, three, four, five, seven, six, eight, nine.
These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
That is probably one of the most famous, or the most famous, of all television ads for a presidential campaign. It was played and paid for only once.
Right. It appeared on I think it was NBC, which was doing a world premiere of The Diary of Anne Frank. So you can imagine the intensity that people had watching it, at least a sizable portion of the population. And this comes on, we must either love each other or die.
That's the voice of Lyndon Johnson, and he's saying, in effect, if you elect my opponent, Barry Goldwater, you're running the risk of being faced with a nuclear war.
They did that in several other ads, that campaign in 1964 as well, but indeed, this one, the memorable one, ran once, but it has been played over and over and over. It has become the icon, if you want, of the... advertising via television, and it makes a rather startling either-or situation.
You know, I've never told you this. That year, the year of that campaign, I was at Dartmouth College on a kid assistant professor kind of job, and somehow I became one of the two people running all media for Lyndon Johnson's campaign in the upper half of the state of New Hampshire.
Well, with startling things here. You're a Democrat and you're in politics.
It was a long time ago, yeah. But you remember in the ads for that year, a great slogan for Goldwater was, "In your heart, you know he's right." And the Democratic counter to that was, "In your heart, you know he's nuts."
Far right, wasn't it?
No, "In your heart, you know he's nuts."
I never heard that. I know that they did alter one billboard outside Atlantic City. "In your heart, you know he's right." Yes, extreme right.
That too.
Was one. And, of course, Goldwater's acceptance speech drove that home strongly, where he talks about extremism and the pursuit of virtue is not an evil or things like that.
In the defense of freedom. Extremism in the defense of freedom is no virtue, whatever. Yeah.
And it started...
So the attack ads and the the suggestion that the opposing candidate will bring catastrophe, that's not new in American politics.
Well, no, it's not new at all, but the Goldwater had, was, I mean, there were people writing articles that were psyching him out, looking at his, deciding that he was absolutely crazy, yeah, paranoid, because he had a habit of, you know, sort of shooting from the lip and letting, he wasn't very diplomatic as a politician, and that scared right. a lot of people.
Now, you're going to take us on a tour of advertising in American presidential campaigning, and the first stop we've got goes way back to the election of William Howard Taft.
The point in bringing this up is to suggest that you know, books have been written on this topic, and nobody ever mentions this particular piece. This is from a Victor phonograph record put out in 1908 when Teddy Roosevelt decided he wasn't going to run for re-election and that indeed another Republican should follow on in the progressive tradition. And William Howard Taft assumed that role, and he is the Republican candidate. And this is a phonograph record in which he gives a little speech, and you could buy it and take it home and play it for your friends.
This is before radio. If you want to hear him, you have to buy the record.
Long before radio, 1908.
Was the record on sale, or did they give it away for
free?
No,
it was on sale. Oh, I could imagine they bought some to give them away, but it was a regular Victor phonograph record.
Shall we hear it?
Roosevelt has set high the standard of business morality and obedience to law. The railroad rate bill was more useful possibly in the immediate moral effect of its passage than even in the legal effect of its very useful provision. From its enactment dates the voluntary abandonment of the practice of rebates and discriminations for the railroads and the return by their managers to obedience to law in the fixing of tariffs. The pure food and meat inspection laws and the prosecutions directed by the president under the antitrust law have had a similar moral effect in the general business community and have made it now the common practice for the great industrial corporations to consult the law with a view to keeping within its provisions. It has also had the effect of protecting and encouraging smaller competitive companies so that they have been enabled to do a profitable business. But we should be blind to the ordinary working...
What did he say?
Well, he's really talking about how he's going to carry on Teddy Roosevelt's tradition of progressive reform and protection, as well as reform of big business. You can see the technique is very stilted. He's obviously reading a script. It has a long way to go to be what we have in modern campaigns, but on the other hand, it is a very early, if not the first, a very early attempt at electronically transcribing the human voice and making it available for mass distribution.
Now, commercial radio begins around 24-25, isn't that right?
Well, 1922, they say, the first commercials. 26 is when NBC is founded, 27 yeah. CBS.
24, WGN Radio.
One
As a matter of
first.
Fact, this is our 80th, we celebrate the 80th anniversary this year. So what was the first campaign in which radio was used?
Well, up until the 1930s, for the most part, to use radio meant simply to give a speech. Mm-hmm. We don't have commercials. We don't have many gimmicks. It's basically time that is bought by the Republican or Democratic National Committee. And Harding or Coolidge or Cox or whomever will give a short address. The one of the early discoveries about radio, however, was made by the Democrats at the convention in 1924, when they went the old-fashioned way. They won 104 ballots before they came up with their candidate. The Republicans chose their candidate Coolidge on the first ballot. And it gave the impression to a lot of radio listeners that these Republicans have it together and the Democrats don't have it together. And they say, at the time they were saying, that they think the radio coverage was somehow partially responsible for the overwhelming victory of Coolidge.
We've got next in line Hoover in a speech. It says here, Hoover speech excerpted in Republican program Prohibition. Dated 1932. Explain.
This is a segments from a speech that Hoover gave defending prohibition, and he was running against Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. Among other things, Roosevelt was in favor of repeal, of getting rid of the amendment that did away with the use of alcohol.
That was probably in itself a position which guaranteed his election.
Well, I know the Bible Belt wouldn't go strongly for it. They were the ones that pushed it in the first place in the austerity of World War One. But what we have here then is a good example of time bought by the Republicans with their candidate who had been on the radio quite a bit. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt and the fireside chats after he became president was not the first time these guys used radio. But Hoover here is giving an election speech, and he's defending Dry.
The Republican National Committee takes pleasure in presenting President Hoover's position on prohibition in his own voice, as given in his address accepting the nomination for the presidency.
Now across the path of the nation's consideration of these vast problems of economic and social order, there has arisen a bitter controversy over the control of the liquor traffic. I have always sympathized with the high purpose of the 18th Amendment, and I have used every power at my command to make it effective over this entire country. I have hoped that it was the final solution of the evils of the liquor traffic against which our people have striven for generations. It has succeeded in great measure in those many communities where the majority sentiment is favorable to it. But in other and increasing numbers of communities, there is a majority sentiment unfavorable to it. And laws which are opposed by the majority sentiment create resentments which undermine law enforcement and in the end produce degeneration and crime. The members of their party to destroy every vestige of constitutional and effective federal control of the traffic. That means that over large areas, the return of the saloon system with its corruption, its moral and social abuse which debauched the home, its deliberate interference with the states endeavoring to find honest solutions, its permeation of political parties, its perversion of legislatures which reach even to the capital of the nation. The 18th Amendment smashed that regime is by a stroke of lightning, and I cannot consent to the return of that system again.
Now that is truly fascinating.
Well, to hear a defense of prohibition nowadays seems so anachronistic, which it of course is. The whole idea of demon rum and its ill effects grows out of a certain kind of fundamentalist Christianity mixed with the austerity of World War One that helped push the amendment through to be passed. And then once the war is over and the country is ready for a bender, they have prohibition.
What do we know about the campaign contributions of Al Capone in that year? Seems to me, for him and for all people involved in the bootlegging traffic,
should have been heavily Republican.
They should have been heavily Republican. They want to keep that amendment in action, don't they?
You would think so. You had Big Bill Thompson, a Republican governor, Republican mayor of Chicago, and the Republicans were strongly, and I imagine a lot of Democrats were in the South, were very, very strongly in favor of doing away with access to liquor. Although liquor for medicinal reasons was legal.
Yeah, like marijuana for medicinal reasons in some states,
right,
not throughout the country. Some commercials are overdue, of course. We'll pause for those and then directly back to J. Fred McDonald. And we're going on to some themes as used in particular campaigns. And the next voice that we will hear, we're not doing this in strictly chronological order, will be Ronald Reagan. Just why will appear in just a few minutes after these words. And once again, here's J. Fred McDonald, president of his own great archive firm, McDonald Associates, who deal in historical film and radio materials, and TV materials, of course. Let's come to 1968, rather to 1984, the re-election of Ronald Reagan. You chose this as the next one in line for a particular reason. What's the reason?
Did I put 1984? Should have been what, 1980? Yeah, 84.
Yeah, he's elected in 80. Yes. Second re-election's 84.
Right. The I want to suggest that, you know, we may be slicker. The commercials now are charted much more specifically to hit certain targets. There are all sorts of polling companies that'll tell the commercial makers what to do.
And they look for themes, don't they?
Oh, they look for themes. They look for vulnerabilities in their opponent and whatever. But things don't change really that much. And I wanted to juxtapose a couple of pieces here. One is the very famous Morning in America, done by the ad agency that did Pepsi-Cola commercials.
And that was the theme of that whole campaign. After those first four years of Reagan, we've entered a new wonderful renaissance in our national life, and Ronnie did it for us.
And what had preceded it, of course, was Jimmy Carter and the malaise,
exactly,
and the tremendous inflations. Yeah. And here it was all solved, and the next is going to be, downhill. I mean, a smooth ride all the way out with the next term of Ronald Reagan.
It's like Winston Churchill's phrase, we've reached the sunlit uplands.
That's right. They have reached they could have used that one, but I guess Morning in America was more concise.
Let's hear it. Lots of people will remember it.
It's morning again in America. Today, more men and women will go to work than ever before in our country's history. With interest rates at about half the record highs of 1980, nearly 2,000 families today will buy new homes, more than at any time in the past 4 years. This afternoon, 6,500 young men and women will be married. And with inflation at less than half of what it was just 4 years ago, they can look forward with confidence to the future. It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than four short years ago?
Boy, that is artfully done. And that's only the audio. What did we see on the screen?
Oh, you saw, first of all, you heard this wonderful music sort of a music of contentment. You saw people in small towns and big cities raising American flags, happy people, pretty people, black and white people. This was put together, as
it
I said.
It must have been a wedding scene when he says 6,500 couples will get married this afternoon.
A pretty girl with the white on, and her handsome groom. All the bucolic images you could think about are all in this little 60-second spot that...
it's beautifully done. Who did it, do you know?
The ad agency was the one that handled the Pepsi-Cola account. And, it has that kind of, all he could have said at the end is, drink Pepsi. But instead, this is Ronald Reagan's world. And it seemed to touch, the responsive chord that every commercial maker, regardless of whether he's selling the president or not, loves to reach.
This is where he's running against Walter Mondale.
Who starts out his campaign by saying, we need a tax increase, which is not a good way to get yourself elected. And especially after we've come through these horrific years of problems with money, that Reagan, it just seems to say, we've solved the problems, now let's enjoy.
Speaking of Mondale, remind me, what was the use that they made of Where's the Beef?
That was in one of the debates where they used the Clara Peller line from the Wendy's commercial.
That was it,
where she was saying, we've all this stuff, but where's the beef? And Reagan asked, where's the beef?
Oh, it was Reagan who used it against Mondale.
I think so, yes.
I remembered it the other way around. But you have an interesting point that you made when we were discussing this just before we came on the air, that this Morning in America sort of theme is to be found much earlier in American political advertising.
Yeah, in fact, we can go back 50 years to a speech that was on the radio nationwide, but it was here in Chicago at the Chicago Stadium in October of 1936, with Franklin D. Roosevelt running for re-election, and he says the same, not as slick, no music in the background, but if you listen to what Franklin Roosevelt had to say, he's saying the same thing.
We're about to hear it.
Mr. Chairman, Governor Horner, Mayor Kelly, my friends of the great state of Illinois, I seem to have been here before. Years ago, I dropped into this city from the airwaves. An old friend coming a new way to accept in this hall the nomination for the presidency of the United States. I came to a Chicago fighting with its back to the wall, factories closed, markets silent, banks shaky, ships and trains empty. Today, those factories sing the song of industry, markets hum with bustling movement, banks are secure, ships and trains are running full. Once again, it is a Chicago that smiles, and with Chicago, a whole nation that had not been cheerful for years is full of cheer once more. On this trip, I have talked to farmers, I have talked to miners, I have talked to industrial workers, and in all that I have seen and heard, one fact has been clear as crystal. That they are part and parcel of a rounded whole, and that none of them can succeed in their chosen occupations if those in the other occupations fall or fail in their prosperity. I have driven that point home. And tonight, in this great center of business of the nation, I give the same message to the businessmen.
It's great to hear his voice for many reasons. One of them being, he really was a master performer, wasn't he?
Oh, he had a twinkle in his eye and a twinkle in his voice. There's a certain kind of a confidence that his voice exudes at a time when confidence was probably very much in need.
And that aristocratic at home with oneself kind of inner strength.
There is no equivocation. This is a man who is in charge, and the Americans, and that election particularly in 36, followed him in masse.
In 36, who's running against him?
Alf Landon.
Alf Landon. Of course, he beat Hoover in 32, and it's Alf Landon in 36 who got two states.
That's right. Kansas was one of them, his home state.
Kansas and...
I think Vermont or one of those.
Vermont, I do believe. He was or had been the governor of Kansas.
And the father of Senator Nancy Cassidy.
Who later became a senator indeed. In fact, let's look at him. Rather, let's listen to him. Because it's from the same time. This means a bit of a jump on our playlist. We go to our number 8. Here's Alf Landon. And he is making the opposite argument, isn't he?
This is from a campaign film, a 20-minute campaign film in which Alf Landon speaks, in which the announcer also drives home the point that this New Deal has been a disaster for America here in 1936.
So Roosevelt says it's morning in America, but Landon says...
it's a disaster.
Landon's presidential campaign special has been received with tremendous enthusiasm at every stop. Ovations that prove the American people are looking to Landon to free them from the burden of the New Deal. Such receptions indicate the rising tide of sentiment throughout the nation for the candidate. He is winning country and city alike by his campaign to restore the government to the American people. In Nebraska, he lashed New Deal spending.
There are many things that we want government to do. There are many things that government should do. But I believe that a man can be a liberal without being a spendthrift.
In Iowa, Landon urges the voters to inform themselves on the issues.
I hope the people are going to read the magazines and the newspapers and listen to the political addresses on the radios as they have never done before, and then go and vote as true Americans that they all are.
At his birthplace, West Middlesex, Pennsylvania, Landon proves a hero to his old hometown. Here he's leaving church with his great aunt. At Buffalo, New York, in his wind-up speech of his first campaign swing, Governor Landon assailed the New Deal tax bill on corporation surpluses as having the following effect.
It is making harder and harder the reemployment of many of those at present out of work. And it is jeopardizing the job of every man and woman who today is working for a business corporation. This is the most cockeyed piece of tax legislation ever imposed in a modern country.
If you want a real recovery, if you want industry to expand, if you want to see the sparks fly again, forging a greater America, if you want...
Well, Al was a pretty straight talker, wasn't he?
Yes, but not...
Not an unattractive presence, I think.
But certainly there's no way Mondale was going to win. No way Alf Landon was going to win, given the success of the Reagan and the FDR first term.
You remember the wonderful line he got off at a Republican convention? I forget which one it was. Not very long ago, he appeared only a year before his death and gave a speech in which he said, "Your reception warms the cockles of my heart, whatever those are."
That's the kind of confident repartee that I think endears politicians who can handle that, who can do that. A lot of people are so scripted they can't do that.
It's time for us to pause for some commercials, and then we return. Where are we going next, in fact?
I've got
next in line is, I think, let me just quickly consult here. Oh. Yes, we go to 1944.
We're going to start talking about celebrities.
About celebrity endorsements of presidential candidates. All of that to follow right after this. And we return to J. Fred McDonald and to presidential campaigning via the media. And here we go back to we go on to 1944. There are lots of Roosevelt material because there were many Roosevelt campaigns. Four in all.
Exactly.
And this is the last one, 1944.
This is one he did not campaign very much in. But what we see now is...
we were at war and he was ill.
And he was ill. Very ill. As we know, he died in April of 1945 and was elected in November of 44. So he didn't serve very long in that fourth term and was, of course, replaced by Harry S. Truman. But the idea that celebrities can add an oomph to a presidential campaign is not new. We know, for instance, that Al Jolson stumped quite a bit with Warren G. Harding in the 1920 campaign.
Well, you know that. I did not know that.
Oh, there's even film showing them, not a commercial film, but, I mean, newsreel-type footage of them. And, of course, newsreel was one way in the early 20th century that politicians got their message out there. Just as today, they try to make news and get out on...
So Al Jolson was the Ben Affleck of his time.
You could say
touring with
that.
A presidential candidate.
He was just a forerunner of so many others where they affiliate with their favorite candidate and go out on the hustings or make radio shows.
Now here we've got a radio show with James Cagney. It says Kay Wynn. That would be
Keenan Wynn,
G. Marx's Groucho, and Humphrey Bogart.
This was the night before the election in 1944, and this was an hour special, I think it was on NBC, that the Democrats bought and had an all-star cast, and they had average people mixed in there, too, you know, telling their stories or anecdotes, but it was the big-time movie stars that was so important.
It's worth hearing. We got a full four-minute clip. I think we'll play the whole clip.
This is Jim Cagney, member of the Screen Actors Guild. I guess I'm just an old sentimentalist about those bygone days when the gangsters I used to play in the movies were rum-running all over the place. But under the first Roosevelt administration, prohibition was repealed, and bootlegging became a lost art. Soon afterwards, Roosevelt's Department of Justice took care of the mobsters in general. Well, as I say, I feel pretty mellow about those dear old days, though I hope you'll understand it if I break down and sing a song together with two other sentimentalists, Keenan Wynn and Groucho Marx.
remember those dear old bygone days of the rugged individual and the dole, dole, dole. Remember Herbie Hoover and his sweet old-fashioned ways, and Harding with his record black as coal,
oh, black as coal. In that good old Hoover time, in that good old Hoover time, lots of jobs for everyone who lays blues and crime. Money singing everywhere, and you spare a dime. Don't go back with Dewey to that good old Hoover time.
Do you remember those anti-labor laws? The struggle of the drives against the wet, wet, wet. Remember Teapot Dome and relief for every home, and the tear gas bombs and bullets for the vets.
For the vets. East side, west side, all around the town. Banks were busting right in your face. Stocks were tumbling down. Dirty round the corner, red lines round the block. Don't let Hoover bring Dewey to the sidewalk of New York. Yuck, 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 yuck. Mm. We don't want a depression just like the depression that ruined dear old dad.
In memory of the Red Communism Scare, which has been used by the Republicans with distinguished lack of success in 1936, 1940, 1944, Dewey marches off!
The old Red Scare ain't what it used to be, it ain't what it used to be, it ain't what it used to be. The old Red Scare ain't what it used to be a few short years ago.
The old Red Herring, the old Red Herring. It talks like Hitler, but it smells like Gary.
The old Red Scare ain't what it used to be a few short years ago.
Don't look now, folks, but is anybody interested in a better world?
We want to have a better world, better world, better world. Want to have a better world, we got to get out and vote. Now we're on the right track, right track, right track. Now we're on the right track, we're going to win the war. The track ahead is clear now. Let's keep those engines humming.
Well, that is utterly fascinating.
That's fantastic. That was an hour of your favorite stars on live radio. Why wouldn't you vote for another term?
Notice, he's still running against Hoover.
And exactly, he's still running.
Dewey is made the modern equivalent of Herbert Hoover.
And the issues of 1932, even though in many cases they're pretty well under control, if not solved, are still great political fodder to whip the other side with.
But the reference to the Red Scare, they're accusing the Republicans of using a Red Scare and doing it dishonestly. But just 4 years later, when Harry Truman is running to serve a full term, he evokes the Red Scare, doesn't he?
Well, I think he probably had to if he didn't believe it anyway himself, but his loyalty oaths that he imposed on government
employees. The Cold War was on again.
And the Cold War itself, but the idea of domestic communism as a political issue, the Republicans would use that. They would continue to use that topic well into past the Reagan administration, till the fall of communism, essentially. It was a motherlode after the Cold War set in. As long as the Soviet Union was the ally of the United States in 1944, you couldn't get very far with a Red Scare.
Was Hollywood then, as it apparently is now, pretty much on the side of the Democratic candidate? Has it always been?
For the most part. I mean, there were people like Ginger Rogers and Robert Taylor who supported Dewey in 1948.
And Adolphe Monge was a great conservative.
Adolphe Monge, who told the House Un-American Activities Committee he could smell a communist. He was that sensitive. It's interesting, two of the most prominent, or three of the most prominent people supporting Harry Truman in 1948 were Lauren Bacall, Humphrey Bogart, and Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan at the time was, I think, president of the Screen Actors Guild and a strong union man.
And what first commended Reagan to the country as a political figure was a famous speech he gave. Was it just the night before or a few nights before the election that Goldwater lost so magnificently?
Right. The 1964 election, Reagan, who had been more or less moved conservatively through his marriage to Nancy Davis, through his affiliation with General Electric, or for many years a spokesman for that corporation, delivered a speech where he out-Goldwatered Goldwater, and he was more eloquent, he seemed more attractive, he didn't have the same kind of tough, you know, in-your-face attitude that Goldwater had. If you don't like me, then don't vote for me attitude. Reagan was charming and a much softer, better sell. And, of course, the modern Republican Party grew, was planted that year.
Remember the great story, whether it's apocryphal or I would like to believe it really happened. Somebody comes to Jack Warner and says, they're going to run Ronnie Reagan for governor. And Jack Warner thinks about it and says, no, that's wrong. Jimmy Stewart for governor, Ronnie Reagan for best friend.
Right, a bigger headliner than Jimmy Stewart. It's interesting because Reagan ran for the governorship of California in 1966, and I was a student there at the time, and he sent out these little phonograph recordings on a thin little sheet of plastic that you'd put on the spindle of your 45 RPM player, and you would play, and it was Ronald Reagan giving a little speech about what he called common sense. Something that, anybody has common sense, meaning that I don't have a political background, but, you know, I have common sense and I need to be elected.
Now, without identifying this Hollywood star, he'll be recognizable almost instantly. He may very well give his name at the beginning. I'm not sure. But here's a Hollywood star working for George McGovern in 1972.
I want to talk to you about our Dollars for McGovern drive and why I hope you'll join it. One of the biggest questions in this campaign is who our country belongs to. Does it belong to the big corporations like ITT and the oil interests who make large secret contributions and expect favors in return? To leaders of the Pentagon who insist that we pay more and more to big defense contractors whether we like it or not? Or does it belong to you and me? President Nixon received $10 million from secret contributors. There must be a reason why he can't tell us who they are. To match Nixon's millionaires, George McGovern and Sergeant Shriver need a million average Americans, a million-member club of people willing to make a small donation to their campaign. Join us today and send $25, $10, or whatever you can manage. Thank you very much.
You should give away a prize if you're...
Everybody
listeners
would recognize that voice, don't you think?
Well, maybe not. Maybe not.
That's Paul Newman.
That was Paul Newman, and this is very interesting. It was on a telethon. That's how poor the McGovern campaign was in terms of campaign funds. This is only a few weeks before the election, and they're up in Wisconsin. It wasn't even national. They're in Wisconsin trying to raise money. Well, on a telethon, call in and ask George McGovern a question for 1 hour. And the commercials in it included this one with Newman, also with Carol O'Connor, and with Barbara Streisand.
Of course, he's running against Richard Nixon, who's running for his second term. If you go way back, we have Nixon running for his first term. And, yes, here we are in 1960. And again, the theme is communism. This is number 16 on our list, I need to say, because I'm jumping around in the order once again. What is this, a speech to the country? Or?
This is Nixon sitting on a desk, you know, just pontificating.
It's a commercial then, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a commercial. Pontificating on a topic that brought him to power in California in the 40s and to the vice presidency in 52.
Mr. Nixon, what is the truth about our ability to fight the growing menace of communism?
Well, first, we must recognize communism for what it is. Mr. Khrushchev understands only strength and firmness. To apologize to him just means weakness. Our next president must show clearly that America won't stand for being pushed around anywhere in the world. When Mr. Khrushchev says our grandchildren will live under communism, we must answer his grandchildren will live in freedom. When he says the Monroe Doctrine is dead, we say the doctrine of freedom applies everywhere in the world. The only answer to communism is a massive offensive for freedom. Freedom from hunger, from disease, and a victory for the ageless hope of people everywhere. Freedom from tyranny.
Vote for Nixon and Lodge, November 8th.
Sounds a little stiff to me.
Exactly. He in the 1960 campaign, Kennedy ate him up on television.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the old cliche that in the great debates, those that listened thought yeah. Nixon won. Kennedy was photogenic, glib. He had that style. He had it.
And Nixon sweated. That was his and, his classic
debates, but Nixon in his own commercials is not very good. He's stiff and pontificates.
Speaking of commercials, we've got some of those, not for presidential candidates, but for yet other things of great import. And when we take care of those and get a quick update on the news, then we'll listen to Nixon in 1968, when he seems to have improved a good deal.
Quite a bit.
Directly back after this. And again, we are talking tonight with and being guided through a wonderful archival collection by J. Fred McDonald, who has collected this material and thousands, hundreds of thousands of other items in your vast warehouse.
Hundreds of thousands, many hundreds of thousands.
That warehouse serves McDonald and Associates, a historical film and radio and television archive, which serves and services film producers, television documentarians, news broadcasts, just about everybody.
Everybody in the media looking for old imagery, yes. Mm-hmm.
If I am doing a television documentary for PBS, and it's to be about, let me see, World War One, I would probably give you a ring or send you an email.
Yes, that's the kind of client we get. World War II, we get people doing, for instance, WGBH just finished a documentary very timely now on Julia Child, a biography of Julia Child for the American Experience.
Really?
We had footage that fit into their documentary. They did one on the woman who developed the Barbie doll for Mattel.
It's interesting about Julia Child. I've got footage on Julia Child as well. She was on this program a number of times. I couldn't easily locate it, but we did some wonderful programs with her.
Well, as you well know, you can have wonderful things, but if you don't know where it is,
exactly so,
you don't have it.
Exactly so. Now, we were talking about Nixon and how stiff he was in 1960. You're convinced that when it came to political advertising and self-presentation to the nation, he did better 8 years later.
Well, just think of that 1960 commercial on television. It's Nixon in a suit sitting on a desk, sitting on the side of a desk, mm-hmm. you know, trying to be casual, and giving this rather monotonous statement about communism. By 1968, his commercials are highly edited, quick pictures, themes with music behind them, a punch, a scare tactic in some of them about crime and fear and Vietnam and how he's going to take the crime out of the streets. And what you hear in these next commercials contrasts dramatically.
Crimes of violence in the United States have almost doubled in recent years. Today, a violent crime is committed every 60 seconds. A robbery every 2.5 minutes. A mugging every 6 minutes. A murder every 43 minutes. And it will get worse unless we take the offensive. Freedom from fear is a basic right of every American. We must restore it.
Dissent is a necessary ingredient of change. But in a system of government that provides for peaceful change, there is no cause that justifies resort to violence. let us recognize that the first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence. So I pledge to you, we shall have order in the United States.
We shall have order.
And the sign at that moment comes up, you know, vote for Nixon, vote as if your whole world depended on it.
Is that one television commercial or two?
Those were two. Those were two. He did lots of commercials.
What's the visual in the first one?
The first one is a middle-aged woman at night walking down a lonely street and looking warily on either side, the idea that she could be attacked. Very obvious. Crime rates were high, student protest and other forms of violence were rife in the country. We know from the 1968 Democratic Convention here in Chicago how powerful the image of violence impacted the Democratic candidate. And so the Nixon turnaround is dramatic. I mean, he is now really being marketed and sold professionally, not just a stiff, old-fashioned. I mean, Nixon in 1960 reminds you of Herbert Hoover in 1928, except he's not in front of a radio microphone, but he's sitting there giving a little speech.
Yeah. I've got to ask you, though we weren't planning this, and we're not particularly here to talk about this year's campaign, but it is underway. And we see some commercials. And, of course, we've seen the treatment of the one convention. We'll shortly see the treatment of another. The speeches at those conventions are obviously very important for mounting the presidential campaign. What do we do now that's different from what we did for 8, 12, 16 years ago?
Well, the one big difference is the use of the Internet. You alluded to it in the opening of the program. We have seen that the Democrats are able to raise enormous amounts of money. The Republicans apparently thought that they had a real advantage in money given the old-fashioned way, going around to dinners and asking important people to give money. But the Democrats have been able to raise even more money through, and now with MoveOn.org and other non-campaign organizations, they continue to raise money and spend it. They've outspent in the last 2 weeks.
Well, they've also had a strong assist from people like George Soros, who gave them about $10 million.
Well, but the Republicans have always had people who give, you know, millions of dollars, and the Democrats have always been the party of poverty because their constituency, for the most part, is working-class people who don't have that kind of money to give away. But the Internet has leveled the playing field.
These days also consists of trial lawyers who give them a great deal of money. And various kinds of firms are also covering their bets on both sides of the street.
I think that is pretty obvious, Milt, that the big firms are giving to both parties now because they don't want to get out there on a limb.
Well, they've been doing that for some years.
But not in the amounts, not in anywhere near equal amounts. The Republicans have always been the favorite, and now it may not be 50-50, but it's not a 90-10 anymore.
Back to the historical material. We go to hour number 9, and this says... This is 1964. We're back to the Goldwater-Johnson campaign, which Goldwater lost so decisively. And this says, female voice anti-Goldwater spot.
I think this is a good example of the refinement of the television ad where you are now targeting an audience. This is an audience aimed, this is a commercial aimed at women. It is nothing more than a cute little girl licking an ice cream cone. She's eating an ice cream cone, and the camera's on her. She's about 6 years old, and a female voiceover. That is unusual to have a female voiceover, but it's a mother talking about her daughter, or is any mother talking about any daughter. And it has a strong anti-Goldwater message that the atomic testing is going to bring strontium-90 and cesium-60 or whatever into our children's ice cream.
Well, this is sort of parallel to the famous Daisy Picker ad that we started the program with, even though that ran only once. The message there was, elect Goldwater and you may get nuclear war.
This is akin to it. And there was still another one where a woman is walking in a glade with her young daughter, and the idea is that they could be fried if we go back to testing in the atmosphere.
And the victim in all three of those, then, is a young girl.
A child. The vulnerable child, female child, exactly.
Do you know what people used to do? They used to explode atomic bombs in the air. Now, children should have lots of vitamin A and calcium, but they shouldn't have any strontium-90 or cesium-137. These things come from atomic bombs, and they're radioactive. They can make you die. Do you know what people finally did? They got together and signed a nuclear test ban treaty, and then the radioactive poison started to go away. But now, there's a man who wants to be president of the United States, and he doesn't like this treaty. He fought against it. He even voted against it. He wants to go on testing more bombs. His name is Barry Goldwater, and if he's elected, they might start testing all over again.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
Well, that's really scare advertising.
That's tremendously effective and scary, and you can't get much more negative against your opponent than to suggest that he's going to fry your daughter.
Who did that campaign? Do you have any? What firm was in charge of all the media then?
A guy named Tony Schwartz. He did the Daisy ad, and
same guy.
This may be the guy.
Yeah.
He later became infamous in Chicago. He's the one who did the glove voting for Verdoliak. Remember that commercial against Harold Washington, and it was actually was a black hand voting for Verdoliak, and Harold countered it by simply saying, "Oh, it was a white guy wearing a dark glove," and blew it out of the water. But Tony Schwartz did not have much success in Chicago, but he certainly did with his ads, and he may have been involved with this one.
You know, I'm suddenly remembering Lee Atwater. Now, his role was in the election in 1988, the election of the first President Bush.
Yes.
And they used some pretty negative ads against Dukakis, didn't they?
Lee Atwater had a reputation for playing a mean guitar with a rhythm and blues band for a Southerner, but he also had a very mean political disposition who felt basically anything was fair in love and politics. Mm-hmm. And he was not above using a kind of viciousness and the Willie Horton ad.
The Willie Horton ad is the key one. The other one was the Boston Harbor, as I remember it.
Right, the pollution in the water that supposedly he cleaned up Boston Harbor, and it was that was mild, and that I think was pretty fair. But the idea that the Dukakis was voluntarily let a rapist out, and this rapist ended up killing another woman was in the standard of the
same
Goldwater.
Standard. You remember the end of the story, Lee Atwater, not very long thereafter. Gets cancer quite early in life, and he dies. And he's facing death for about a year while he's undergoing treatment, and he repents of what he had done and tries to apologize to everybody that he assaulted through his ads.
Yeah, he did apologize. Whether they accepted it is another story. The same thing, Roy Cohn, I think he confessed on his, repented on his deathbed. Senator McCarthy's assistant, who was also a pretty vicious politician. And as you can see, the Willie Horton ad, it has predecessors. I mean, to suggest that your daughter is going to be melted in an atomic bomb if this crazy Republican, Barry Goldwater, is elected because he wants to bring the strontium 90.
So Democrats and Republicans have been equally guilty of this kind of stuff.
I think politicians have been guilty, yes. And,
they were way back in Republican Rome. If you hear Cicero carrying on about Catiline, it's just about as nasty.
Well, of course, Carthage must be destroyed. You say it enough times.
Cartagena delenda est, yeah. And we must do our commercials. We'll pause for some of those right now, then right back to J. Fred McDonald. It'll be a while before we get to the phones, but if you want to wait in line just a bit because you've got something to say or to ask, you could give us a ring at 591-7200. And we return after this. And now, back to J. Fred McDonald, and we're zeroing in on one particular election, the election in which Eisenhower and Stevenson vied for the presidency in 1952. Why is that so important in our story?
Well, I think it's the most important one because everything is mature and comes together, and this is where television first really enters the presidential campaign strategies of both parties, but particularly the Republicans, who are leaders in this, because a couple of years earlier they had tried it in the Pennsylvania state elections with a judge named Fine, who becomes governor, and the governor named Duff, who was elected senator. And it worked out beautifully. And we know that the Dewey people had tried commercials, and Dewey's campaign manager will become James C. Haggerty, the chief of spokesman for Eisenhower. Once he's elected, he becomes Eisenhower's press secretary. So the Dewey relationship is also important. But here we have major advertising agencies coming together, BBD&O, Batten, Barton, Durstein & Osborne. We have Young & Rubicam executives. We have Ted Bates executives who come together to create commercials and to sell Dwight Eisenhower to be president. Now, don't think it was a shoe-in. To have a general become the civilian president was a big philosophical debate. And Americans and militarism, they don't go together.
Well, the last time that it happened before that, I guess, was Ulysses S. Grant. Is that right?
Well, we had Teddy Roosevelt had been a colonel.
Yeah, he wasn't.
But to actually have a general, a major general of that report, you'd have to go back to Grant.
Right. Now, we start with Jimmy Dodd, whoever he was, singing.
Jimmy Dodd later became the chief singer of the Mouseketeers. He was a minor actor and a minor singer. But what we have here is even before the nomination, when there was a big argument between Senator Taft of Ohio, a conservative, and General Eisenhower, the darling of the moderate Republicans, this is a program that was actually on WMAQ in July of 1952 in order to influence delegates, not for the general public, it's to influence the delegates. And here, taking an old song, I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover, he sings a very strongly anti-Taft song.
Hi, Chicago. Here's a song everybody's singing.
Taft is the loser, a four-time loser, and we mustn't lose with him. We want a winner, and Ike is the man. We'll put him over, and we know we can. Taft is the loser, a four-time loser, and we want a victory. So hail Eisenhower, the man of the hour, and victory for GOP. Everybody sing.
Taft is a loser, a four-time loser, and we mustn't lose with him. We want a winner, and Ike is the man. We'll put him over, and we know we can. Taft is a loser, a four-time loser, and we want a victory. So hail Eisenhower, the man of the hour, and victory for GOP.
Yeah. I can believe that guy became a Mouseketeer. It has that sound.
It has that enthusiastic sound.
Yeah.
But here they are trying to, using radio, to influence the delegates that the Republican convention held in Chicago. And indeed, they would reject, it would be a big debate, reject the conservative wing of the party and go back to that more moderate wing that Wendell Willkie had represented.
Next one up is a jingle simply titled Ike for President. Now, is that from a television commercial?
This is a good example of a television commercial, one of the first ones, but it's a cartoon drawn by the Disney people,
really,
with a catchy little song. It takes you back to as early as 1936 when Alf Landon's campaign had a political cartoon that they ran, a six-minute little piece called The Fable of the New Deal. In 1944, we know that Franklin Roosevelt ran a cartoon that was made by the Merry Melodies people from Warner Brothers, Chuck Jones, called Hellbent for Election. And here, then, in a 30-second jingle, reminiscent and great cartoon, we get one of the first.
Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike?
I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike.
Ike for president.
Lay off the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington. We'll take Ike to Washington.
Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president.
That sounds like a toothpaste commercial.
It could very well be, except it was a Disney cartoon and a catchy little song.
Next, Eisenhower Answers America. Now, this is a commercial on television, I presume.
This is one of the first TV commercial series. They did a series called Eisenhower Answers and then sometimes Eisenhower Answers America. They were put together by a man named Rosser Reeves, who is famous for the Anacin ads with the little boxes in the head that said, oh, I get tension headaches, uh-huh. or I get a rope that will be twist to symbolize the tension. But what's interesting about these is they were 20-second spots. They would have people come in and ask him questions, and each one had a different kind of target. And for 20 seconds, each one would last. You could package them and sell it as a 20-second spot, or you could put three of them together and get a one-minute spot. And in this one, we get a black man who says, the Democrats tell me I've never had it so good, and Ike answers them. We have a woman ask or a man asking about waste in Washington, and a woman with a bag of groceries who talks about inflation. And Ike answers each one in his 10 seconds of each 20-second spot, put together to be a one-minute spot.
It's really well compacted, I guess.
Well thought out and strategically important.
Eisenhower Answers America.
General, the Democrats are telling me I never had it so good.
Can that be true when America is billions in debt, when prices have doubled, when taxes break our backs, and we are still fighting in Korea? It's tragic, and it's time for a change.
Eisenhower Answers America.
General, just how bad is waste in Washington?
How bad? Recently, just one government bureau actually lost $400 million, and not even the FBI can find it. It's really time for a change.
Eisenhower Answers America.
I pay $24 for these groceries. Look, for this little...
A few years ago, those same groceries cost you $10. Now, $24. Next year, $30. That's what will happen unless we have a change.
A paid film.
Huh. So in that quick little order, three major hot button issues, what he did is he went into the studio and did the answers, and they went out and found the people and meshed them together to make the questions.
Yeah, rather sounds like a Johnny Carson cartoon routine, you remember?
What's that?
Well, where he gives you...
Oh, that's right, the Carnac.
The Carnac routine, exactly, where he answers the question.
He gives you the answer, and then the answer, he divines the question.
Exactly. I'm struggling to get that one right. Well, so that's Eisenhower Answers America. And now we have Stevenson Answering Eisenhower.
It's funny, because most people who write don't think that Stevenson did very much on television, but indeed he did. And, again, these are the things you find out when you get these old films and you begin to fill in the history, that unless you find these kind of old things, you never know happened.
This next one is direct Stevenson talking to the country, is it?
And it's a good example of how boring and stiff he was, much
really?
Like... We encountered Nixon in 1960, uh-huh. and as we encountered Hoover in 1928, talking about the road ahead.
AES, Adlai E. Stevenson, a new voice in the land, speaking of the road ahead. Listen.
Political crepe hangers are going around the country now, explaining that our economic system is bankrupt. If they would close their mouths and open their eyes, they would learn that the people of this country are better off than they or any other people have ever been. That we are reshaping not only our nation, but the whole world. That our country is teeming, bustling, with new ideas and new industries. That our youth are tough and strong and alert. And may I say to you that if we believe in progress, we will always believe that it's time for a change, democratic change. Time for a change to a better and a freer life.
AES, Adlai E. Stevenson. A man who looks ahead to meet the challenge of tomorrow. Vote for Stevenson.
Well, that might move you.
Oh, you would have to already be committed to Adlai Stevenson for that to really get you excited. He wasn't
merely flat. He had also a touch of what Roosevelt had, a sense of aristocracy, a sense of being sort of an upper-class smart fellow.
Well, he had that, but he's still, in the film era, you've got to be much different. And in television, much more different. He did a campaign film where he's standing behind a podium. I mean, George Wallace did that in some 1968 mm-hmm. commercials I have. Standing behind a podium is not going to endear you to people in the visual media. And Adlai Stevenson just didn't understand what John Kennedy in TV Guide in 1959 wrote an article saying that in the age of television, you've got to be good looking, you've got to have affability, and it comes across. You've got to be able to sell yourself on television. And General Eisenhower, who wasn't particularly glib, read that off a cue card, but he came across much better because his handlers knew, don't put him on for more than 10 seconds.
Here's another attempt to puncture the Eisenhower balloon. This is not Stevenson performing. You've called this one the Ike Bob commercial. What is that?
Well, this is a good example of a negative campaign, one of the first negative campaigns in television. Now, on the radio, the Republicans were really, really strong in 1952 in attacking Stevenson. But in their commercials with Ike, they were compassionate and sympathetic. But here we have an attempt to ridicule Eisenhower to suggest that he is really simply a pawn of the much more conservative Robert Taft of Ohio. So we take this old acting school exercise where you say a word or two words over and over again in different inflections. And here it's Bob and Ike.
How does this connect to the Stan Freberg routine?
Well, Stan Freberg had made a recording in the same year, I believe, in 52, called John and Marcia,
where he's mocking soap operas.
Well, yeah, exactly, but just saying John, Marcia, and then he would change it in different ways, and each change of voice connoted a different kind of temperament.
And here we go to Ike Bob, and the Bob of reference is Robert Taft.
Bob Taft of Ohio, considered the bete noir of the Taft-Hartley law as far as Democratic laborers were concerned.
So Ike is supposed to be more liberal than was Bob Taft. The truth is they are the same fellow.
And that he's really a pawn of Bob Taft.
Of Bob Taft. Let's see how they do that.
Ike.
Bob.
Ike.
Bob. We must lower taxes, Bob.
Yes, Ike, we must lower taxes.
But we have to spend more for defense, Bob.
You see, Ike, we agree perfectly.
Bob.
Ike.
Bob.
Ike.
Will Bob give Ike the additional money for defense after Ike cuts taxes? Stay tuned for a musical interlude. Reuben, Reuben, I've been thinking about the general and his mob. If you're voting for the general, you really are electing Bob. Let's vote for Adlai and John.
Well, isn't that fascinating?
Yes, and so, most scholars who have written on the 1952 election suggest that there was very little television presence and creativity in the Stevenson campaign, but we have at least five or six of the Adlai Stevenson speeches that are 1 minute long, and quite a few of the Ike Bob and other mocking commercials.
Ike and Bob in the television, on the visual side, are represented as bullfrogs?
Oh, well, they know it's two hearts. It's a heart with a double heart with an arrow through it, like a love image. But their voices almost sound bullfrogish.
You said bullfrog as we were listening to it. And I thought you were telling me that that's what we see on the screen.
No, but they're deep, you know, croaking almost sound. It's a heart, a still picture of a heart with arrows through it. They're in love with each other.
We are going to pause for a quick round of commercials, and it is time indeed to really invite telephone calls. Anything you want to ask about what you've heard, or anything you want to remind us of with regard to other modes of advertising during presidential runs over the years, any particular commercials you remember or speeches you remember that you think are noteworthy to understand how we have developed the art of political campaigning via the media, give us a ring, 591-7200. The number, we look forward to your contributions, and get them in right now, if you would, 591-7200. And we hope to go to the phones in just a few minutes after these words. And back to J. Fred McDonald, and on to your calls in just a moment. But first, I got to get your reaction, Fred, to this. Aldous Huxley, in 1958, did a book titled Brave New World Revisited. And he says, the methods now being used to merchandise the political candidates, the political candidate, singular, as though he were a deodorant, positively guarantee the electorate against ever hearing the truth about anything.
That's very interesting, because about the same year, Richard Neuberger, the senator from Oregon, was adamant in his denunciation of television and what it had done. You know, the idea that we would elect somebody who puts on makeup to, you know, that to hide his reality, in other words, who puts on makeup and reads from scripts rather than the authentic person, is that kind of purist reaction that that is drowned out, and now it's even a whimper. We have sold ourselves to the salesmen, and the salesmen have sold us our leaders, and we can't go back.
Well, it is true that these techniques have altered the nature of American political life, don't you think?
Oh, just as, you know, the good orator always had an advantage over the bad orator, and the guy in that way, when they come up with electronic microphone, the person with the soft voice finally was given a level playing field. Calvin Coolidge in 1924 was elected, some say, also because he had a sharp nasal voice, and in the primitive radio equipment of the day, his voice came through beautifully.
That's why Kate Smith became a famous American singer. The same point is made about her with regard to the transmission qualities of early radio.
Not a great singer, but the Songbird of the South had a sharp voice that was wonderful in its compatibility.
And we go to the phones now. 591-7200. If you want to join us, move quickly. There are one or two lines available. And here is the first caller. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. Very interesting program tonight.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
A couple of quick observations. I noticed that some of the commercials seem to be intentionally and almost subliminally evoking other unnamed individuals. And I was thinking most of the two Nixon commercials were in both of them, even though Nixon's a Republican, he quotes directly from Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech.
Freedom from fear.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in the Johnson anti-Goldwater piece, the woman doing the voiceover narration sounds almost eerily like Jacqueline Kennedy to me.
Well, that's an interesting observation. And quite possibly, you know, they chose a person for that reason. These politicians are smart. They want Nixon wanted Democrats to vote for him, and if they could, he could get a little bit of Franklin Roosevelt. He wouldn't mind that at all. And I think if you listen to the contemporary politicians, Bush and Kerry, both would borrow from their speechwriters. Both would borrow freely from the opposite party. If, in fact, we know that Kerry is has taken some Reagan-esque type of rhetoric and integrated it into his commercials.
It reminds me of when Ronald Reagan declared Harry Truman to be the father of the modern Republican Party.
Well, he was a strong supporter of Truman back in 1948, and he was among others with Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, and other liberal Democrats, as he was at the time, thought that Truman was the greatest president for the time.
Sir, well, thank you for the call. Glad to have heard from you. An email. But first, let me once again invite telephone calls. We've got room on the board. Call quickly if you want to get through, 591-7200. With any questions or memories of presidential campaigning via the media in the more or less modern age. This one from a listener in Atlanta asks, Senator William Proxmire was famous for spending almost nothing on his many successful re-election campaigns. Was he a historical aberration, or is it still possible to win with, quote, free media?
I think it's possible if you have such a reputation. You can't win the first time that way. But if you have a reputation and the other party is in disarray, as, for instance, the Republican Party is in the state of Illinois, I think it is possible to get along with minimal amounts of expenditure.
It may well be that one of the things that determined the invitation to Alan Keyes was that he's a great performer on the podium. And speaks very effectively in when you pick him up on television.
And I think that what I also heard is that the Republican Party was kind of fearful that Obama, who instantly made a national reputation, would start traveling to some of the swing states to lend his rhetoric.
That reminds me, I should tell our listeners that Alan Keyes will be our sole guest on this program next Monday night. That's Monday at 9 o'clock for a full discussion with Alan Keyes about what he promises to the nation and more particularly to the citizens of Illinois. 591-7200 is our number. I should add, of course, also that we've got an invitation out to Barack Obama's group, and we hope that he will be with us sometime soon as well. And here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, Milt. Two quick corrections and an addendum if you have time. First of all, where's the beef was used by Walter Mondale in a debate with Gary Hart?
Did you send us an email to that effect earlier?
No, I didn't.
Because somebody else did, and we were discussing that off the air, I guess. And I think what we reconstructed is that, yes, what this caller is saying is correct, but then later, so Mondale used that against Hart, and then later Reagan borrowed it and used it against Mondale.
I believe it. The Republicans saw what a wonderful thing it was, and it became, it was, it transcended the Democratic primary and became a Republican weapon against Mondale, suggesting, you know, there was no substance there in Mondale's candidacy.
It's like using "There You Go Again" against Ronald Reagan, except that never worked.
And in 88, Al Gore was the first person to use Willie Horton in an ad against Dukakis. It wasn't the same ad, of course, but he did use Willie Horton.
Well, the most memorable one, the one we see over and over in the mass media, of course, is the one that the Republicans used with the swinging door, suggesting that criminals were just pouring out of Massachusetts prisons under Governor Dukakis.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Interesting contribution indeed. 591-7200. We will return to the phones directly after we pause for a last round of messages. And speaking of our audio archive, a new one has just gone up today, a new program. That's our conversation just last week with Jack German, the veteran Washington reporter and lovable curmudgeon, who is also far more liberal than I am, so that we engaged in a certain amount of friendly debate over important aspects of the current American situation or dilemma, as the case may be. We go back to the phones, 591-7200, 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to comment on the 1952 Republican convention, which was held here in Chicago at the stadium, whereas the gallery at that time was packed with Eisenhower supporters. And at the time of the first ballot, Bob Taft had a greater number of delegates, but he did not have enough. And the audience chanted, maybe you remember this, Milt, kept chanting that, "We like Ike, we like Ike, we like Ike." And the delegates that had not yet voted, some of the states held their votes back, began to sway toward Eisenhower. And before the first ballot was finally concluded, enough had committed to Eisenhower that there was never a second ballot, and that Eisenhower won that on the very first ballot. And the interesting thing about that, there was one or maybe two states that were committed to send it to General MacArthur as favorite son, and MacArthur had come to Bob Taft before the first ballot and said, "Let me release my delegates to you." And Taft said, "I don't need them on the first ballot. You can release them on the second." And, of course, as you know, there was never a second ballot. And Eisenhower won the delegation or won the nomination on the very first ballot.
Well, that's a very interesting review of something that I didn't remember in that detail.
Yeah.
Does that check out, Fred?
Yes, but it also meshes with the idea that in the age of television, because it was televised, the convention, and in the age of instantaneous mass media, electronic media, you can't go many ballots. It looks you are confused.
That's correct. And that really was one of the last really genuine nominating conventions. So many of them are chosen ahead of time today, as was the Democratic and as will be the Republican one.
Well, the vice presidential nomination for Adlai Stevenson's 1956 run, as you remember, he threw it open to the delegates.
That's
and it
right.
was Kieffer and young John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which it was very exciting. I can recall that yet as a kid watching that. And Kieffer won and Kennedy gained great publicity, which didn't...
Yeah, there's one little final comment. General MacArthur was chosen by Taft ahead of time between themselves, and not on a vote, but between themselves, that he would be the vice president under Taft. And, of course, as you know, Taft died about less than a year later of cancer, maybe a little over a year. And, of course, had Taft won the convention, why, then General MacArthur would have been the vice president and ultimately the president.
Oh,
so history has a way of...
protecting us.
Yeah, well, protecting or maybe... in reflecting back that we missed some opportunities, you know.
Well, it makes us appreciate, some of us appreciate President Eisenhower all the more.
Thank you, sir.
Well, that may be, yes, sir.
Thank you. A very interesting contribution.
Thanks, sir.
And let's go quickly to another. Good evening. You're on the air. Are you there? Apparently not. So we'll go to this caller. Good evening. You are on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Another great show, Mel. If I could quickly just comment before I get to my original comment about a few callers ago had mentioned Nixon and his reference to Roosevelt. I thought that was very perceptive because if you read his first inaugural, Nixon, he references Roosevelt and compares what he sees in 1969 and compares to what Roosevelt saw in 1932 or 1933, I guess it would be. So it was, mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty perceptive. One commercial that sticks out in my mind, and probably none of your audience has even seen it. I used to live in New Hampshire, and you know, every 4 years you're just bombarded with political ads. And Richard Lugar was running for president in '96, or for the nomination, and he did a commercial on international terror. The whole theme of the commercial was based on international terrorism, and I thought at the time I thought, well, that's interesting, and you know, no one was even talking about that in 1996 that I recall. And here is his commercial in the primary was based completely on international terrorism, and it's one of the reasons why today, whenever Senator Lugar speaks, I listen. And I thought it was pretty perceptive.
Well, he certainly has become the major spokesman in the Republican Party for a traditional diplomatically sensitive, intelligent foreign policy, and his sensibilities about terrorism, no doubt, were informed by the top secret information to which he was privy as an important member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and so maybe it wasn't as prescient as it seems to us now. It's just that he knew a lot more than we did at the time, and we weren't ready to accept it as we certainly are now.
Sir, well, thank you
for the call.
Glad to have heard from you. You and I agreed we wouldn't particularly get into the current campaign, but rather look at things historically. And I've much enjoyed the wonderful material that you made available and your always astute comments. Without any electioneering, but looking at the present campaign, do you see that either side has any advantage just in terms of the skills that they're bringing to bear?
Well, one disadvantage for Bush is that he has to run on a record, whereas Kerry doesn't really have to run on a record. As they say over and over again, and it's obviously true, that when a man is running for, when a president is running for re-election, he's running on his record, and whether or not we want another 4 years of that. And it's really, if the contender is intelligent, solid, and an acceptable alternative, they will vote for or against the president based on what he has done for the first 4 years.
But one might note that it's a matter of some curiosity that that Kerry has a record as a senator. He's been a senator for a long time, but he's not running on that at all. He's running on his record as a naval lieutenant for 4 months in Vietnam.
Well, he's doing very well on every major issue running against Bush, except on the who's tougher against terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has to emphasize whenever he gets a chance, particularly on free media, like at the Democratic Convention, he has to emphasize the military background he has. Issues of economy he can talk about out on the stump, but up there it's I'm as tough as Bush.
Did you shrivel just a little when he got up to do his acceptance speech at the convention and he gave that salute and said, reporting for duty? That was obviously planned in advance. It was obviously probably somebody else's idea about how to stress his military background, but it was so cynical, I thought, that it made me a little embarrassed for the man.
I think it was terrific. I thought it brought home immediately that this was a man ready
the
to
message,
come on board.
I see.
And you know, as a staunch Democrat, I thought he was right on target.
We're going to end with one thing on your playlist that we didn't get around to, but it has some special interest. JFK with Harry Belafonte. Explain quickly. Time is very short.
Harry Belafonte introduces him, and here's John Kennedy and his pregnant wife sitting in a Harlem apartment with a black family, and we got a good example of targeting a specific audience, in this case, the African-American vote, which was very crucial in John Kennedy's election.
Hi, my name is Harry Belafonte, and I'm an artist. I'm not a politician, but like most people in America, I have a great concern about the political and the economic destiny of my country. Right now, I'm sitting in a community called Harlem. It's one of the largest Negro districts in America. And I'm sitting in the home of a Mr. and Mrs. Boyden, who are from North Carolina, who live in Harlem, and who are typical of the Negro families that live in the Harlem community. Mr. and Mrs. Boyden have invited as their guest Senator and Mrs. Kennedy for an impromptu and an unrehearsed discussion about the topics of the day.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Harry, and I know my wife and I are very grateful to Mr. and Mrs. Boyden for having us here today. I'd be glad to answer any questions that are of interest to you. This is an important campaign because it's an important time in the life of all Americans.
Senator, what do you aim to do about the civil rights was passed in 54, Supreme Court?
The Supreme Court decision in 1954 provided that the schools should be integrated, and I believe that we're going to have to make progress towards implementing the Supreme Court decision. It is part of the Constitution. It provides basic equality for all Americans, particularly at the beginning of their lives. The kind of education they get under the kind of conditions which are fair can really determine what kind of a life they're going to have, what kind of jobs they're going to own, what kind of home they're going to own. And therefore, I believe that the President of the United States should associate himself intimately with this great moral question of providing equality of educational opportunity, equality of employment, and all the rest for all Americans, regardless of their race, or their color, or their religion.
Senator, what do you...
Well, that's a fascinating one to end on, isn't it?
It is. It's our, in a sense, martyred president, and
yeah.
A man like Roosevelt that both sides draw from.
Mm-hmm.
You remember the tax cuts that Kennedy brought out, Reagan and even Bush have talked about.
Fred, thanks so much for coming once again. We get together every year or two and do one of these, always with your wonderful archival material. And I trust we could do it again.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and I look forward
to next year at this
time.
Yes, indeed. I still remember that great Vic and Sade program that we did years ago, and which people sometimes mention to me. We have been talking with and benefiting from the archive collected by J. Fred McDonald, president of McDonald Associates, a historical film and radio archive.